The Heidi Marie, a 72-foot lobster boat out of Stonington, disappeared at sea on November 21st, 1989, or the next day.
Another boat is lost from Stonington Harbor. Lobster man this time, God help the sons and daughters of the ones who make their living.
The Coast Guard searched for the vessel for 11 days. For several of those days, Day reporter Joe Wojcicki was on board with them. Joe, how did you arrange to accompany the Coast Guard?
I think I came in that day and I had been down at the town dock talking to fishermen about the boat and the people aboard it. And I came in the newsroom. It was around dinner time, I think. And Lance Johnson, the managing editor, we had heard that and he had said that the Coast Guard was flying search and rescue missions out of Elizabeth City, North Carolina, on these big C-130 planes. That we had an opportunity to go down there and fly with them and fly to rescue if I wanted to go. And of course I said yes. And I had, I think, about an hour and 15 minutes to get to TF Green Airport to get a flight. And I ran home, threw some stuff in a backpack and just got to the airport and basically got on the plane when they were closing the door. So that's how we started to go down there. So,
do you think that you had, was that unusual access for a newspaper reporter to accompany the Coast Guard?
I think so. The Coast Guard's easier than some of the other military groups. They're a little more open sometimes for obvious reasons. But they said, come on down if you can get here. And I remember I showed up at, I don't know what time it was. It was the middle of the night. It was after midnight. And the watch commander welcomed me. I had driven over to the base and he said, you can go sleep in my office for a couple hours and we'll wake you up when we're going to go, which was about 4:30 in the morning. So I was hungry, dehydrated and everything else and slept a couple hours and they came and got me to go.
So this is in November and you're down in North Carolina. Tell us about going aboard that
C-130 transport planes that they use for searching. And it's just basically an empty cargo plane in the back with some seats. They all welcomed me. They were all really nice. The pilots all went to the Coast Guard Academy. So that was fun because I would sit sometimes in the cockpit on the floor with them during the searches and chat. And they wanted to know about New London. Mr. G's was still there, Campus Pizza. They were very, it was help being from New London. That really helped with them. And, I sat in the back and they gave me a headset. It was cold. It was incredibly turbulent. It just incredible turbulence was unbelievable because they fly about 500 to 1,000 feet off the ocean floor, the top of the ocean. So the turbulence is crazy. They just go up and down in these grids and they look out the window. It's no science to it. And so that was interesting. I think I started to get sick about 2 hours in. And they were funny. They're like, don't worry about it. We all get sick too. We always get sick. No big deal. And sure enough, one of the crewmen, she was thrown up into a bucket. And I was like, okay, I don't feel too bad. I'm not the new guy here. So that was kind of fun.
Okay. So I believe in the first telling of this, you said you were puking your guts out.
Yeah, I was. I mean, I was pretty sick for about an hour or so. And then I didn't have anything else, any other left in my stomach. And I remember at one point on that first day, they spotted some debris and they said, I can't imagine anybody doing this today. But they said, do you want to help us put the buoy out? And I said, sure, why not? So they put me in a harness and tethered me in and they opened the back door of the plane. And I was sitting there with my feet hanging over the edge and it's 500 straight down. You were hundreds and hundreds of miles offshore. There's nothing around. They let me help me put the buoy in and everything, and just to give me an experience of what they were like. So
you drop the buoy from 500 feet to mark the spot where the debris was,
where then a Coast Guard cutter could come by and check it out and see if it was anything important. So we flew, I think, for 10 hours, maybe something like that. That first day. Yeah. And it's incredibly exhausting just looking out at the horizon and And so it was, it gave me a real insight at the hard work that these guys do. And they eat box lunches. It's like, it's just tough work.
Did you have a good sense, when you left there of who was on the Heidi Marie and who owned the Heidi Marie? Was this something that you'd been covering as part of your writing about?
I wasn't that familiar. I knew it was an offshore lobster boat. I knew it was locals. We obviously had known the names of the gentlemen who were aboard. So I knew a little bit, and I talked to some people at the dock that I knew about these people. But, you know, I didn't know a ton about their lives, you know, but we just did know that, you know, 500, you know, that five people were missing. And it would have been what the biggest tragedy had hit the fleet. And I think in its history, I mean, they lose people every once in a while, but not in a five people at one time. So
okay, so you went that first day out of where did you fly?
Elizabeth
out
City, North Carolina.
And you did a round trip after 10 hours
back. We did a round trip, yeah.
Okay, do you remember much from day two and day three?
Well, at the end of day one, I didn't have any clean clothes. So I went to the mall and I bought a pair of jeans, a sweatshirt, and a Charlotte Hornets t-shirt. And they were the first year they were in the NBA, so I was so excited about the first Charlotte Hornets t-shirt. And I stopped at the drugstore and got a bunch of Dramamine, which I just began to eat because I knew the next day it was going to be another 10-hour day on that plane. So we went out the second day, kind of much of the repeat up and down. And it was funny, when I would sit in the cockpit in the morning and just sit on the floor and talk to the pilots, and they would tell me like who was joining us because there'd be other aircraft assets and boats. And then they would say, and there's one we can't tell you about. They'd be like, there's an aircraft that's classified. We can't tell you that it's with us today. And I was like, oh, okay, that's fine. And then one day, I think it was the second day, but they said, we can't show you this one. And the pilot said, look out to the right. And I looked, and it was a B-52 bomber. And it was on its way to Iceland for some, I don't know why. He said, it was on its way to Iceland, but we figured they could fly they do these grid searches, and they said they could fly one grid next to us, so they were helping out along the way. It was pretty cool to see one of those in the air next to you. It was pretty neat. So
that's quite coordinated. By the way, getting back to the debris that was spotted on day one, what was your understanding of how that was followed up on after you?
Yeah, they radio it into the cutters, and they steam out there, and then they, you know, follow the tracking buoy, and then they go pick it up. And they thought it was a life ring, but it was a life ring from whatever boat. You know, it turned out not to be from the Heidi Marie, but it was some debris from a boat that had got away. So they check everything out. They send people out there to look for every single thing. And the interesting thing was, at the end of the second day, they were kind of wrapping up, and I think that was the day they actually called the search off. I think it was at the end of there was the end of the second day, and we found some other debris, and it was near the end of the trip. And I'm in the cockpit on the ground, you know, just listening to all the transmissions, and they're going back and forth with the cutter about what they need to do. And they had a report. I don't know if the cutter saw it, and they wanted them to go find this other debris that, oh, the jet had found. A jet had seen some. So they want us to go over and mark it. And so the pilot says, okay, let me check. And he says to his co-pilot or the I don't know what the guy, the navigator, can you see where this is and what's our fuel situation? And the navigator says, if we go there, we don't have enough fuel to get home. And we're out hundreds of miles. And so he says to the cutter, he says, hey, we can go there, but we don't have any fuel to get home. We it's outside our range. And the cutter says, well, we need you to go there. You're just going to have to. And that's all I heard. And there was silence. And I said, excuse me. And the pilot said, yes, Joe. I said, did I just hear correctly? We can't get home if we do this. He goes, don't worry. He goes, we're going to divert. He goes, we're either going to go to Bermuda or we're going to go to Cape Cod. And I said, I've been to Cape Cod a million times. I'd love to go to Bermuda for the day. And he says, well, if it's close, we'll make it there. We ended up on Cape Cod. So I'm close. So my work is done with them. So I'm in Cape Cod in a hotel in Hyannis. And I'm like, I'm close to home. You know, I could call my wife and she could come pick me up. except my rental car is in North Carolina and I have to go back and turn it in. So I had to fly a whole nother day with them for another thing that they were, I can't remember what the mission was, but I had to fly.
Okay, so you got back on to a Coast Guard plane to get back down to North Carolina.
Yeah, I flew on the same plane. We had to do some other mission. I forget what it was.
And that's day three.
There's 3 days with those guys. Yeah,
But you're not looking for the Heidi Marie on
day three. The third day we weren't, just the first two.
Wow, yeah. Okay.
Yep.
So, okay. And do you have a sense of what was going on back in Stonington while you were on board? And did you write stories for the day at the end, or were you sending stories home at the end of these grueling long days?
I know the story and I can picture it. I know because I think I wrote it after the second day. Somehow and transmitted it, I think, back then in the, dark ages of doing that. But somehow I think I managed to get a story home after the second day, if I recall. And that was published. And then I think we did a story late, maybe when I got back, too. And I brought photos back with me of being on the plane, too, of the buoy and dropping out the back of the plane and all that kind of stuff. So, but it was pretty apparent at that point that, that they were lost. I mean, there was no sign.
Yeah, so the Heidi Marie was never located.
No, never found. No sign of it. Yeah, that was.
And the five were considered
deceased.
Yep. Yeah. So let's skip forward a decade, Joe, when you visited the home of one of the crew members.
Sea gives us our living, but she takes back many men, and the trawler men and the draggers think.
Sure, I did. We decided we would do a story on the 10th anniversary of the Heidi Marie, because like I said, it was the biggest disaster in the fleet's history, kind of bring people up to date. I think we got the official Coast Guard report on it, which, that talked about what they thought might have happened. And then, of course, we sought out some of the families. And I know I remember talking to Mark Middleton's parents. They live somewhere else, not around here. I remember talking to them. I think it was mom or his dad. And then Arthur Banks, who was a 25-year-old from North Stonington. His family has a long history in the fishing fleet. His dad, I think his whole family has fished over the years. And they still lived in Mystic. And I remember calling his dad, Arthur Sr., and set up a meeting with him and his wife. There's certain interviews you do in your career that never leave you. And this was one of them. I still picture today is like clear as day. I met them at their home in Mystic, we were sitting in their kitchen, and just talked about what life's been like for the last 10 years and what their son was like, and just their thoughts about what happened. And the Mrs. Banks proceeded to tell me about the morning when she got the news, and she said that it was Thanksgiving morning and her son was supposed to be back to the dock around lunchtime. That's what they had predicted. And she said, so she was got up really early because she had a huge turkey to make and she prepared it and everything. She said it was about 5 a.m., I think she remembers saying. And she prepared the turkey and she turned on the oven and she put it in the oven. And then she said, my plan was to go back to sleep for a couple hours. She goes in and get up and start the rest of the process. She said, and so she went back to sleep. She said, and I fell back to sleep. She said, and next thing I know, she says, I'm sleeping. Next thing I know, Arthur, her son, who was on the Heidi Marie, is standing next to me. And he says, Mom, everything's going to be okay. And she said, she looked at me, she said, just like I'm looking at you right now, he was looking at me. He says, Mom, everything's going to be okay. She said, and then the phone rang. And I opened my eyes, she said, and it was the phone. And I knew something bad had happened. And her husband got up, and got the news. It was the Coast Guard calling to say that they've called, their son was missing, and that was it. So it was like one of those things that always has stuck with me. I'll never forget her saying that to me and telling me that story.
She was convinced
that her son had come and just to tell her to not to worry, he was going to be okay. So it was kind of, you know, so you walk out of it a little shaken. And it's one of those stories that I always say writes itself. You don't have to do anything. She just gave you one of the greatest stories you're going to write, and it just tells itself. So it was an interesting day in my career.
Unbelievable, Joe. And you have followed the Garbo Lobster Company for many years.
Yeah, I definitely have it. You know, David, I got to know David a little bit, you know, when he was running the operation at the town dock, and then he moved to Groton City. So he lives in Stonington, and actually even written a feature about his son who was an aspiring stock car racer at one point. So I know him a little bit, yeah.
Okay. And by the way, you have been part of a Coast Guard search that was successful?
I have. It was I actually wasn't on the boat, but I was on the tail end of it and got to see a happy reunion. And this happened just about 3 years after the Heidi Marie. There was a boat called the Lois Joyce. It was a fishing boat. There were actually five gentlemen from North Carolina, but they spent a lot part of the year up here fishing here and bringing fish into Stonington and living here. And so they developed a close relationship with the other fishermen. They were like part of the fleet, even though they were from a different state. And I remember we got word that their boat was missing. And I went down to the dock and was talking to people about them, and everybody had wonderful things to say about them. Everybody was, you know, people had come down and gathered families, and they were all consoling each other because they thought, oh no, not again. 3 years later, here goes, we're going to lose another five people. And the Coast Guard was out searching for them. And then we got word, I think I came back to the newsroom, in one of the afternoons, I came back to the newsroom, and we got word that they had been located. And we heard, I think the Coast Guard said to us that they had been floating out there far off the coast of New Jersey and south of Rhode Island for a couple days. And they were in this tiny little lifeboat, and the Coast Guard got them, and they airlifted them. One of the gentlemen was a diabetic, Walter Tate Jr. And they airlifted Walter. They got him aboard, you know, like you see on TV, they got him aboard, pulled him up on the helicopter, and they flew him to Cape Cod Hospital. And so once I heard that, they said he was on his way to Cape Cod Hospital, that's what their plan was, to take him to Cape Cod Hospital. So I went in against, and Lance Johnson was still the managing editor, and I said, hey, Lance, I go to Cape Area. I know exactly where the hospital is. I can get there if I drive really fast in an hour and a half, and I can get there. And let me see if I can talk my way into the emergency room. Once again, this was 30 years ago. Probably couldn't pull that off today, no matter how hard I tried. So I got there. It was, and we had deadline. I wanted to make deadline. I think I got there. You know, it was like deadline was later then. I probably could have went to about 10, got there around 8 o'clock or something. And we had a story written, but I wanted to get the information. I said, this is our chance to interview a survivor right off the, you know, just as he's being treated in the hospital. So I went in, I talked to the shift, the nursing supervisor, explained to her who I was, but that I was the only one that this gentleman was going to know, even though I didn't know him. But I knew a lot of other people, but that I was the only one that would have a connection with him. And I was wondering if I could talk to him. And she said, well, I'll see what I can do. And I was like, okay, this is good. And I called in, backed into London. I said, look, I'm going to try. I might be able to get an interview with him. You know, half hour went by, and I'm like, to look at my watch, I'm like, deadline's coming up. I got to get in there. So I went back up, and I said, you know, you think I could get in to see him now? You think he's okay? And she says, yeah, well, he's not really hurt. So she said, all right, hold on. And so she comes back. She goes, okay, come on in. So I went in, and I introduced myself to him, and I dropped a couple names of guys in the fleet that I knew. And I said, you know, I know someone. Oh, yeah, you know. I said, look, can I ask you a few questions about what happened? And he was, oh, absolutely. And he proceeded to tell me this tale about them floating in the ocean, you know, in this tiny little raft. And they were letting him eat the provisions because he was a diabetic. They didn't want him going to a diabetic.
And it's January.
And it's January. It's cold. And And I remember he said at first they were, the first day they were joking about how they were going to get new jobs after this because they're not going to do this anymore. And then it got pretty serious. But he said it, and I'll never forget this. I said, is it, once again, it's like one of those quotes you hear in your career and somebody says, and it really has never left me, is he said, we were sitting in the boat, he said, and we all made our peace with God. They were a very religious group of men. But that's what he said. He said, we all made our peace with God because they didn't think they were going to live. And he told me, and I was like, whoa, here, once again, here's my story written for me. And I said, just as I kind of finished up my interview, and I was like, I got to hurry up because I got to call this in. His couple of his family members, his sister showed up, his brother-in-law, and then another fisherman from Stonington. It was a tearful reunion. There was a lot of hugging and crying and whatever. And I was there for the whole thing, just sitting in the emergency room watching this whole thing. So once again, story writes itself. I don't really have to do much because my material is right there. So, but that was a happy, happy reunion. The rest of them, I think, got brought back here into Stone, or probably to London.
As another
something.
Crew of five.
Another crew of five.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Joe. You've been covering the fleet for a long time, and you have some great stories to tell.
Thanks.
We'd like to thank sea musicians Rick Spencer and Don Indermule, who joined us in the studio to perform Heidi Marie, their haunting song about the missing boat and the danger faced by those who make their living harvesting the sea. This podcast, produced by Assistant Managing Editor Carlos Peterhen, is dedicated to the lost crew of the Heidi Marie and to their families. They are Arthur Banks, Kenneth R. Gould, Mark Middleton, Raymond V. Morris, and Michael N. Hare.
When the morning comes to Stonington, our boats will be on the harbor. Some are leaving, some returning with the harvest of the water. And on the mind of everyone, though not a word is spoken, is who will be the next to go to fish and not return. Hard winds of November, cold arms of the deep, bold spirit of the fisherman, cast your lots upon the sea. Hard winds of November, cold arms of the deep, bold spirit of the fisherman.